The Guardian.
We know you all love football, but if you fancy taking a break from the beautiful game, here's an offer you won't want to miss. Right now on guardian.co.uk, you can watch the award-winning film Skeletons, starring Jason Isaacs, and you can save 10% just for being a listener of Football Weekly. Skeletons is the story of a pair of travelling psychic detectives helping people remove the metaphysical skeletons from their closets. It's eccentric, heartfelt, and very, very funny. The film costs just £3.49 to stream or £5.49 to download. And you can save a further 10% by entering the promotion code SAVEME. To check out the trailer and to find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/skeletons.
Hello and welcome to Football Weekly Extra. I am Max Rushton, sitting in for Jimbo for two more shows. And after Monday's bafflingly successful pod, I received almost no criticism on the blog. So we're going to change that. Much like the tricky second album, Thursdays are never quite as good as Mondays. Although yesterday I discovered that I might be a nihilist, so it doesn't really matter anyway. If you carry on listening, you will find out the following: which minor celebrity I was drinking with last night, just how fattest Barry Glendening is, and if Michael Essien will ever get married, and we will probably talk about football a little bit. Right, on this journey through football, we have a panel. Rafa Honningstein is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
You were late.
I was.
Barry Glendening is here.
Hello.
Sean, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
What's the question, Rafa?
What happened to your eye?
I have a black eye. I was punched by a referee on Saturday. Although I wasn't arguing with the ref. He was one of these 90-year-old men who just stands on the halfway line. But he gave us a free kick and he quite over the top blew his whistle and just swung his arm out and it smacked me in the face. And we were 2-0 down. We got back to 2-2. We then scored the free kick. He disallowed the goal for offside. No one was offside. Then he said it was indirect. When we said there's no longer indirect free kicks for obstruction, which I believe there isn't in football anymore, he just said, too late. And then they went on 1-4-2. So add insult to injury. It's not too bad a back.
But what were you doing standing really closely behind an 19-year-old?
and a 90-year-old man? What I get up to in my spare time, after, it's none of your business. Sean, you're here again. How's the ankle?
Getting better. Still a bit sore.
Okay. I have very exciting news for all of us, which is not only is Jimbo not here, producer Ben is not here. We have substitute producer Ian, who told me this morning he's boycotted Spurs for not getting into the Champions League. So he hasn't followed any football the entire season. He only discovered this morning that Van der Vaart had left. So we are completely rudderless ship.
On the money.
Yeah. So, right, let's talk about the Capital One Cup over the last two nights. Out of 10, Barry, how excited are you by this competition?
I consistently can't decide whether I think it's worthwhile or a waste of time, but I saw two of the games, Everton Leeds and Manchester United Newcastle. I enjoyed both of them. I think it's one of those tournaments where I said in the fiver yesterday, there's a bit of a saying in Ireland, a good funeral is always better than a bad wedding as a social occasion. So, a good Capital One Cup match is better than a bad Champions League tie. If you take each game on its merits and you're not expecting the moon on a stick, then, there's a good chance you'll get a very entertaining game. And the two I saw this midweek were both entertaining.
Do you look forward to funerals?
No, but if certain people die, you'll sort of go, I'll go to that funeral. That'd be a good crack.
Right, well, let's talk about the Man United game, mainly because you were criticising Anderson for being fat. Then he scored.
Yeah, I was... Someone described it as a partridge moment. But there was this moment, he'd been tackled, I think, and I think he was checking to see if his side or whatever was bleeding or if whoever tackled him had drawn blood. And the camera cut to him just as he lifted up his shirt.
Which you've done for us.
Which I've done for us. Yeah. And like me, he had a sort of a muffin top hanging over the top of his shorts, which I'm not a professional athlete. He is. So, I can probably be excused mine. He can't.
There used to be fat players, didn't there? And everyone looks at Mulby, I guess.
But, Mickey Quinn?
Yeah.
Neville Saville?
I just find it strange that at a club like Manchester United, where Sir Alex Ferguson is such a strict disciplinarian, that some of their players have turned up visibly out of shape this season. Like when Wayne Rooney came back from the summer, he was quite clearly overweight. But, Rooney played very well last night, and Anderson was okay in spots too. He got a splendid goal and was quite good.
Rooney is still touted as the one world-class English player, and I'm interested in your views, as people who watch a lot of football, if that is true. Rafa, is Rooney the one world-class English footballer?
He is, but in that phrase sort of is already a qualification that he's English also, which is his downfall at times. If he was just a world-class footballer, then I don't think we'd be having this debate. But because he's clearly the best in his country, but he still comes with some of the drawbacks that have traditionally plagued some of the better players here. And you feel that for that reason, or that might be one of the reasons why he can never quite fulfill his true potential. If he was living in Spain or in Italy, under different management, in a different kind of lifestyle, you'd think you'd see a lot more of the world-class Rooney and less of the English side.
Isn't Sir Alex the best person for him to be under?
Quite probably. You know, he did finish second top goal scorer last season in the Premier League. I think with Rooney, the thing is he goes through periods where he doesn't score. He looks a bit disinterested. He puts on weight. But there are also moments where he goes on a run and is England's best player. I don't think him and Ferguson got on particularly well. I think the whole Stretford thing, the whole wanting to leave United 18 months ago, I still think that perhaps bubbling under. But yeah, he is the best English player at the moment.
I don't think it matters whether you get on well with your boss or not, though, particularly. And he was excellent last night. He played a couple of splendid long passes and, you know, I was very impressed. And he got the man of the match fizz afterwards. One thing that caught my eye last night with Manchester United, now I don't know if it's coincidence or because they're running some sort of boot camp or it's just footballers copying each other.
Right.
But Manchester United, their back four, had two caps between them. So these four young lads out. But they all look like little identical players with their crew cuts and, you know, similar, obviously out to impress. But they're, in appearance, they were all very similar and all very sort of young privates. And I'm wondering, is this a United policy or just footballers copying each other's style? Because none of them actually look like a footballer with, you know, the gelled, ridiculous hairstyle and whatnot.
And were they wearing black boots?
That, I don't know.
Was Ryan Tunnicliffe one of those? Because that's a great story, isn't it? His dad sticking £100 on him when he was nine.
Yeah, and the bookie only gave him 100-1, which I think presumably tells you all you need to know about the bookmaking industry for a start and how tight they are.
But presumably he was already at United at nine, was he not?
I don't know.
Because if you were, 100-1 seems fair. If it was just a random duffer, if my dad had put £100 on, I'd have hoped he'd got more than that.
My dad wouldn't have dreamt of putting £100 on me.
There is another great gambling story. I saw this on Twitter. I think it was tweeted by Wayne Routledge, if you're interested. Some guy had an accumulator with 15 games and he was upset by Man City. Did you see this? Yeah. £12 and he would have won £151,627.75. I think you would hope that City would beat Villa, wouldn't you? Especially if you've got that bet on. But should Mancini be worried that they're losing at home to Villa?
The qualification is that it was the League Cup and they have these strange results. But I mean, I was chatting to Sachin Nakrani, who's a Liverpool fan, who was at the game last night at West Brom. And he, going back to your original question, he said it was great because they all arrived with no expectations. It was a bit cheaper, the tickets, and they all had a lot of fun. Of course, Liverpool won. And I mean, he was saying great things about Jerome Sinclair, who became Liverpool's youngest ever player last night at 16 years and 6 days. And I was just thinking about, I don't know what you were doing at 16. I mean, I was probably playing kickoff two and Emlyn Hughes' international soccer all the time. And I just think Emlyn Hughes' international soccer, I mean, why would you have him being, you know, kind of the main focal point for your video game? I mean, they could have had Brian Robson, they could have had Gary Lineker. I mean, it's the equivalent now of having Mark Lawrenson's soccer.
I had Brian Clough's Football Fortunes, which also came with a board and a dice. That was really exciting.
There was Peter Shilton, Handball Maradona as well, which was a...
The worst was Peter Beardsley's international football, where you started with three players already up front, and whenever you kicked it, it was just a shot. You couldn't pass. And striker, where it was quicker to slide tackle down the pitch than run. I've got some facts about Jerome Sinclair, 16 years and 6 days old. So he was born on the 20th of September 1996. Ford launched the Ford car, and BBC Two showed the first ever episode of Changing Rooms. Do you have any idea what was at number one?
Spice Girls?
Spice Girls Wannabe had just been displaced by a week, the week before Jerome was born, by Peter Andre's Flavour.
Ugh.
Not a fan, Barry?
No, I was sort of lying at...
Your age.
My age, yeah.
You do love Peter Andre and Flavour.
Yeah.
But exciting for Brendan Rodgers to have all these youngsters. Good for him to get a win. Or is it once again the Capital One?
Yes and yes. I think Liverpool play Norwich at the weekend. I think that'll be quite interesting. I mean, their last 15 away games, Liverpool have lost 9 of them. They did beat Norwich 3-0 last season at Carrow Road. Clearly, they need to start winning. You don't have to be a genius to do that. The bookies think they will. But time and time again, they've not done so on the road.
You just wonder what Rodgers thinks about this 4-3-3 that he seems to be sticking with recently. I just don't see how the players are suited to that system. I don't think that Borini is a wide striker. I don't think that Raheem Sterling is necessarily best in a position so far up the pitch. I think he might be better starting from a little bit further back. I mean, three in the middle makes sense if you're not trusting your back four, which is obviously an issue. But going forward, I don't think really they do enough.
But do you think they look pretty sharp against United at the weekend?
Well, yes and no, because they look sharp in midfield, but do they really look that sharp in the box? You know, that you'd question that. I mean, you'd think that if anyone is maybe a better wide player, it'd be Suarez, because he's not really an out-and-out number nine in terms of his game. But he's playing in the middle, whereas Borini is probably a better middleman, is playing up wide. So I don't know, it just doesn't seem to be working that much. I think they're relying a lot on Gerrard sort of bombing forward and creating things out of nothing a little bit. I don't think that is quite working yet.
Do we think he'll get the time that he obviously needs to have?
I think he will, yeah. I'm not sure how high up the table he needs to finish this year. I think if he finishes in the top half of the table this season, then yes, he will get at least another season.
You don't agree, Rafa?
I don't know, number 10 in the table, I think, will not be seen as enough.
Well, I don't know how knowledgeable or ignorant of English football his American owners or overlords are. But I think if he does not get at least one season and possibly two to prove himself, then that's not his fault. It's theirs.
On a certainly non-intellectual football level, did you see Gabriel Cissé's goal last night?
No.
QPR goal. Absolutely belted this ball, which made me think which footballer could kick the ball the hardest ever. And I wrote Yeboah and Hasselbank, but I just wondered if you guys could think of anyone who... And producer Ian said Johnny Method, which does show the last time he watched any football.
I think wasn't Adair, the great Brazilian player, particularly in the 82 World Cup, wasn't one of his free kicks measured at 110 miles per hour? If I remember my shoot magazines.
With an old ball as well.
Yeah.
Hot Shot Hamish?
Is that a cartoon character?
He was in the... was it Whizzer and Chips?
Dandy.
Or Roy the Rovers comic. But he was a Scottish footballer from the Outer Hebrides.
Hot Shot Hamish.
He used to play, and his sort of midfield partner wore glasses tied with string. He was Mighty Mouse, I think. Hot Shot Hamish could like hit the ball so hard he always burst a hole in the net.
Good.
I wouldn't be surprised if Robert Hoot has one of the hardest shots in the Premier League right now. I once saw him train in a warm-up for Chelsea in Adidas sandals and still booting the ball like a madman, and the goalkeeper got nowhere near it.
The only time I ever went to China Whites was with Robert Huth. We both had moustaches for November.
That's clearly a more relevant anecdote.
How was China Whites? Tell us about
terrible.
It.
It's an absolutely terrible place. Who else was there? I think Liam Lawrence had a table. And,
actually.
You've been as well.
Well, no, but I was on holidays in Greece last week, and I was in a bar watching, and there was a game on TV. And, you know, you had all these Greek players running around, their names across their shoulders in the Greek lettering. And next thing I see, that's Liam Lawrence. I checked, and yeah, it was Lawrence. I said to the barman, when did he was playing for PAOK Salonika.
Mm-hmm.
And playing very well for them. They won 3-0, I think. Can't remember who they beat, but I had no idea he was with them.
Anyway, I would love to tell you all about it, but Ian said we have to move on. I just wouldn't go.
Did you leave alone?
Do you know what? I got the night bus home, and I think I was the only person who left that place and got on the night bus. It's awfully noisy.
A lot of peroxide.
Yeah. This weird thing of you've got this table and there's like a rope, and then there'd be sort of some pretty girls sort of pushed towards the rope, and then you might say, hey, so, you know, hi, what do you do? You can't really hear anything, and they just go, oh, not much. And you're sort of a bit crestfallen. You wouldn't want to find your future wife there, I would say. I think Andy Keogh was balancing a bottle of champagne on his head. But, you know, everything that would make you be sad about the world of football was encapsulated in that place. Really noisy. Right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we look ahead to Super Saturday. And Rafa, if you don't mind, you'll tell us what's going on in Germany. This is part two. No, I did not meet Lenny Lawrence in China White, so that would have been much more exciting. Right, the two biggest games in the Premier League are the early and late kickoff, 12:45 Arsenal-Chelsea, live on Sky Sports 2 HD.
What show does it come on after?
I believe, well, there's a 45-minute interlude, but that I believe that's after Soccer AM, which is your Saturday morning viewing of choice. You've seen one show so far this season,
Ben? Yeah, I saw the one with Jason Biggs from American Pie on, and some guy from Downton Abbey.
Yeah, I've started watching Downton because of it. It's actually quite interesting. I mean, it's not the greatest drama, but... Right, let's talk about Arsenal-Chelsea then. A few people on the blog were unhappy on Monday because we talked far too much about Arsenal, so let's carry on talking about them. Philip Auclair,
they're the most interesting story this season, so you know, you'd expect them to be featuring heavily.
What are they doing right?
First of all, the difference between where they were 12 seasons ago to now is so stark that you just... immediately see that things are working now in terms of the defence. I mean, it's, you know, it's been talked ad nauseum about how they're much better organised. But I think for me, one of the key people in all of this is obviously Mikel Arteta, who's taken over from Song. Song was an imposter, making out that he was this great defensive midfielder. But in a way, he was just a slightly more cultured Stefan Freund, looking very busy, doing very little.
You killed him.
Apart from the odd through ball, which would come off, but then he'd be out of position for about 15 times. And I think the kind of shrug that greeted his departure from all the Arsenal fans told you the real story about where he kind of really stood in the grand scheme of things. And Arteta is actually not a specialist in position, but working all the harder for that. And, you know, he's got a brain, he's got fantastic skill, and whether by accident or by design, they've stumbled upon a solution. The back four gets a lot more protection, and of course they're better organised themselves and have grown individually along the way.
Did any of you think when Arsenal signed him that he'd be this good? Because I think a lot of people are like, it's a strange, sort of non-impressive signing.
No, I mean, he's clearly an excellent player, was an ex-player for Everton, but I was chatting to some Everton fans when he did sign, and they said, well, he's just lost a yard of pace because he'd been injured, and he was in that sort of playmaker role. So for him to be able to come back and sit in front of the back four, I think is tremendously impressive. And as Rafa says, he uses his brain, he uses his footballing ability in a different way than he did when he was at Everton.
People are blowing smoke up Arsenal's backside a lot, but they've won 2 games out of 5 in the Premier League. That's not particularly good.
But then who started brilliant? I mean, Chelsea are top, but no one seems to be that
one seems to have come out of the traps particularly brilliantly, but, you know, just pointing out the results don't necessarily back up.
I think this is a really interesting game, you know, for many reasons, but particularly because Chelsea haven't been completely convinced by them. You know, they're top of the league. Barry and I saw them at Newcastle, and they won very efficiently. But looking back at the history, the last 10 matches they played against City, United and Arsenal, they've lost 6 of them when they've been played away from home. Chelsea also without Drogba, who's been, you know, Arsenal's bogeyman for, you know, several years. Now, there are questions, as Barry says, about Arsenal, but so we're going to find some answers out on Saturday, and I think I'm really looking forward to the game.
On Monday, Philip Auclair said that Chelsea didn't have a midfield. Is he right?
They have a fantastic midfield going forward. The question is whether they can actually cope against a team that will monopolise the ball the way, for example, Atletico Madrid did against them and then completely ripped them apart. And that is why the game is so interesting, because as Sean said, we'll not only learn a lot about Arsenal, but also just how good Chelsea are. Because so far, I think you look at the opposition that they've beaten and you think, yeah, you know, these are all kind of expected results, where I think Arsenal have surprised people by getting a draw away to City, where they probably should have won. If Jovinho could actually play football, they might have won that game. And getting a draw against, you know, a fairly well-organised Sunderland on the opening day, where, you know, things didn't work as well yet.
Of course, the big difference is Arsenal don't have Falcao. They don't have a Van Persie. They have a Giroud. And I think that, you know, means they haven't quite got that cutting edge. True. And a very good goal it was, yeah.
Yeah, great finish. Do we think then that Wenger, more than Di Matteo, knows his best side?
He has a lot fewer options, so it's easier for him, I think, to make that decision. At the moment, the team still picks itself before Wilshere and Rosicki come back. You know, who else can he play? He can vary it a little bit, bring Ramsey in. He's tried him in a wide position, but the back four kind of picked itself because they had first injury to Koscielny. Now, Vermaelen was sick for a day. And up front, there isn't really that much. Giroud has been in and out, but, you know, Cassola, Podolski are starters. Then he can play it around a little bit. But, you know, Chelsea have a lot more options. The problem for them is that they have a lot of similar players, I think, behind Torres. and they perhaps have gone too far the other way. They used to be the team that could never play between the lines and found it really difficult against very good sides to break them down because they were very direct and very kind of vertical. And now they've become very intricate, but they haven't got this power in midfield anymore. So it'd be a fantastic game. I haven't looked forward to a game like that in a long time.
Can I just ask Rafa how Lukas Podolski is settling down in London? Because there were lots of people pointing out that, you know, when he'd gone to Bayern, he hadn't settled and he'd gone back to Köln, and they were fearful that the same thing would happen in London. But yeah, he seems to have started very well.
Well, he really loves it. First of all, he loves it because here he's just another guy. You know, there's no press intrusion at the training centres in Köln. There'd be like 20 guys chasing him every day, wanting a quote before training, but after training, he was always in the spotlight, and it's very difficult to deal with. And he, of course, was the captain, and he was the guy that always needed to justify a bad performance on Köln's behalf, and it was very, very stressful off the pitch. And then I think he's also benefited from Per Mertesacker being here a year longer. He tipped him off where to live. They live very close to each other. They sometimes share the same car going to training.
I was so excited to find out what that was. Sharing the good. don't need to go there.
And Mertesacker is such a switched on guy, and I think.
And he's just playing well now as well.
He's playing well, but I would say Podolski also benefits, I think, from having this guy next to him and being sort of his guide almost to life in London and life in the Premier League, because he's so intelligent, he's so relaxed, down to earth, and I think he has a really calming influence on him.
One final thing we should point out with the Arsenal-Chelsea game, the cheapest general admission ticket is going to be £62 for that game, and I just wondered what your thoughts were.
It's a lot of money. I spent £18 to watch Cambridge lose at Luton.
Away tickets for Manchester United's victory over Newcastle at Old Trafford in the Capital One Cup were £45. The cheapest home tickets for adults were £30.
But this is preposterous. This is where Germany get it right, isn't it? Is it still, you can get tickets for
yes, but
decent prices.
The sort of on the day tickets would be not cheap either for a game like this. So we shouldn't sort of rose tint everything. Well, what is cheap are the season tickets, especially the ones for the real, so the real fans in inverted commas behind the goals, they can go on a season ticket for about £120. That's where the sort of the big difference comes in. But then if you just turn up on a day, I'd guess, you know, Bayern Dortmund, if you could get a ticket, you'd probably pay about €50, but not for the cheapest seat, it'd be a fairly decent seat.
Clubs are entitled to charge what they like, and if fans don't like it, they can vote with their feet and not go. What I find really strange is that there will probably be Arsenal fans defending this cost of £62. Yeah, you know, their loyalty to the club is so blind that they will defend the fact that they are getting fleeced.
But there's nothing you can do about it, is there? I mean, would ring fence a certain means test it?
As long as people are willing to pay, you know, because football's so price inelastic, it's like smoking.
But it's a short. Young people can't afford those prices.
But you're not going to lose. I mean, we don't seem to have lost a generation of young people.
At some point,
supporting
I think
football.
Maybe I'm wrong, but at some point, I think we will. If people, students, can't afford that kind of money. So if they're not going to matches now, why are they going to bother going later in life? Maybe they will, I don't know.
Let's talk about Spurs going to Old Trafford. They haven't won there in the Premier League ever. Last win was 1989.
On the day
Lineker
that
scored.
Lee Van Cleef died.
Was it?
Yeah, and it was all kicking off the Romanian Revolution.
Oh, right. And Vinny Samways was pulling the strings for Spurs. Can Spurs win at Old Trafford on Saturday?
I think it's unlikely, but United haven't been brilliant this season, and I've been quite impressed by AVB. I keep hearing that the media have got it in for, you know, Phyllis Boas, and there's a media conspiracy against them. But I don't see it. I mean, Spurs have won three and drawn three of the last six games. They only lost the open day of the season. Generally, I think people have been at Spurs have generally been complimentary. It wasn't the media that was booing Villas-Boas at half time against QPR.
I think the only thing is his treatment of Dawson was strange, wasn't it? I don't know if I presume you may have talked about this already on the pod, but naming him club captain, leaving him out of the squad seemed a very strange thing to do as soon as you arrive for someone who's, I think, got quite a lot of influence in that squad.
It's not like Dawson is the kind of guy who would have gone out and done something really dim-witted to incur his manager's wrath. He seemed like a model pro. I've spoken to him. He's a very nice fella. And, yeah, it was bizarre.
If they are going to do it, how are they going to do it? Dembele played very well for Fulham at Old Trafford already this season, didn't he?
Well, Manchester United are also quite injury-ravaged at the moment, particularly in defence, hence playing such an inexperienced back four in the Capital One Cup. So that will be a help.
I would like to see Spurs do what Villas-Boas' Chelsea did at the start of last season. They really went for it. And, you know, they lost, I think, 3-1. But they had plenty of chances and it was a very open game. And Spurs so far this season have actually played it quite tight. But I'd like them to have a real go, like a lot of the club sides in Europe have done over the last year, like Bale have done, like Atletico Bilbao did in the Europa League. Just really take on United, particularly with some of their midfield being a bit weak and some of the defensive problems Barry's talked about, and just give it a real go.
Yeah, I think if there's ever a decent time to go to Old Trafford, it's probably now, when United, as everyone has said, don't really look that imperious. They've got a lot of firepower up front, but then very little behind that. And the back four looks a little bit suspect. And, you know, if Liverpool can create as many chances, even with 10 men, why not Spurs with 11?
All right, let's talk Germany, Rafa. To bring Ian up to speed, how is Van der Vaart settling in?
He's settling in tremendously well. He's got an absolute incredible goal last night, away to Gladbach in a 2-2 draw. It's really worth checking out. An unbelievable half volley into the top corner. Fantastic goal. And he was also really instrumental in their first win of the league last Saturday against Dortmund, which also was a bit of a surprise result. Yeah, he's doing really well. Hamburg have found a bit of belief, and you know, it was all doom and gloom before he arrived, and he had to sort of say, "I'm not the Messiah," about five times, and then people thought, "Yeah, well, you would say that, wouldn't you?" And still believed that he was the Messiah. And but he's now actually turning out to be really astute signing, even though it was came at a heavy price and they couldn't actually afford him and had to get a sugar daddy to basically lend them or give them the money.
You mentioned Dortmund. Clearly, they lost the weekend. They only drew against Frankfurt during midweek. They had a sort of similar slow start last season and came good. But what's the mood there at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, they're scratching their heads a little bit, because conceding six goals in one week is very un-Dortmund-like. Even when they had a poor spell last year, they were sort of drawing games 0-0 and losing by the odd goal. And now the defence looks very, very ropey, despite, you know, being very good when you look at the names and look at the way they usually play. Difficult to say whether it's just another function of them being still unable to deal with the Tuesday, Saturday, Wednesday kind of rhythm. When they really struggled 2 years running, as soon as they got knocked out in Europe, then they started coming into their own. And you just wonder, you know, is this the same thing? Is their style, which is sort of all action, hassling the opposition all the time, simply not geared towards that kind of two games a week rhythm? Are they getting simple, smaller things wrong? I mean, Jurgen Klopp, the manager, said, no, this is about small mistakes that we can remedy with training, with doing stuff differently. But there is no doubt that because they play this very aggressive pressing game, if it's not spot on, and if they don't press at the right moment, and they don't actually win the ball when they all press, then of course they're very, very open. Once these teams get out the press, then there's three against three, you know, on the other side, and they were exposed. And even the likes of Hamburg and Frankfurt, who haven't got the most exciting attackers in the world, caused them huge problems. So it'd be really interesting, A, to see if they can recover the weekend, but also if they can finally come good on Wednesday at Man City, which will be a great game. Also, before we move on to another less exciting league, we should also quickly point out that Bayern continued their great run. They won their fifth league in a row, looking very, very good. Top of the league, maximum points. And a very unfortunate injury to Leon Andreasen, who's a bit of a cult figure at Hannover, who'd come back from a really long injury and it was just getting going again. Ruptured his cruciate ligament. We believe, it's not yet confirmed, by getting stuck in the pitch. And the official, or not quite official, explanation is that a Coldplay concert had ruined the pitch.
It's Chris Martin's fault. Okay, cheers, Rafa. That is the end of part two. In part three, Sid in Spain, Paolo on Italy, and minor celebrity news. Welcome to part three. In that small break, Rafa did turn to Barry and C and said, "Where is Jimbo?" But I appreciate that. You know, feedback is always good, Rafa. I like it. And I was out with a minor celebrity last night. Do you want to play the yes-no game on who it was?
I think I might know who it is, actually.
Well, it'll make the quiz quite short.
Well, good. Well, I just saw your conclusions yesterday on Twitter. One of them was, I should eat more fish finger sandwiches.
Yeah.
Was it Captain Birdseye?
No.
Is it a boy or a girl?
Well, it's yes, no, but boy.
Is he a footballer?
No.
Musician?
Vaguely, but that's not what he's famous for.
Politician?
No.
DJ?
No.
Would I have heard of him?
Yes.
Is he an actor?
Yes.
Is he Damien Lewis?
No. Definitely lower brow.
Max Beasley.
No. Well, I have once been out with him.
Is he Ian Bale from EastEnders?
Not Ian Bale.
Is he someone that appears in a popular TV soap?
Yes.
Is he in EastEnders?
No. Get the nationality, not English.
Jason Donovan?
Oh, close.
It's someone from Neighbours.
Yes.
Oh, I know who it is. Is it the actor who plays Carl Kennedy?
It is the actor who plays Dr. Carl. Do you don't know who that is?
No. So it's really, too minor for
that
me.
That is really unimpressive for you, isn't it? Yeah, he's like my hero. I still watch Neighbours. I don't go to work a lot.
You should aim a bit higher.
Right, after that boring celebrity news, let's talk to Sid in Spain. Hi, Sid, you all right?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, jolly good. Now, before we talk football, we have to talk about Michael Essien's wedding, which we went big on Monday, and it was complete nonsense, apparently.
Which I suppose does answer some of our questions about why on earth would he be getting married on a Monday during the football season, and how comes we don't know anything about it. But yeah, we all feel a bit stupid, I think.
All right, Sid, so then what happened on the pitch, Sid?
What happened on the pitch was that Real Madrid were too good for Rayo Vallecano. It wasn't a great performance, but it wasn't bad, and Madrid were relatively comfortable. They still didn't play as well as Mourinho would like, but after the game he was saying that he was satisfied that they looked more like a team than they had in previous games, satisfied with the way that some of the players had performed and about the attitude. But there is still some sort of kind of residual leftover irritation, I think, from previous games. And the way that this has been dealt with in the Spanish media is still to say there are still problems within this team, particularly about the relationship within the dressing room. And it does feel, because there's so many small little stories dripping out, that there are big problems within that squad.
But still, they're going to challenge, aren't they, despite those?
Well, of course they are. But, I mean, you know, they're in a difficult position now in so much as they're 8 points behind Barcelona. They have, I suppose you could say, the perfect opportunity over the next 2 weeks, because this weekend Barcelona go away to Sevilla, where Real Madrid will beat them, and it is a difficult game. I mean, you know, at the start of the season, if you wrote a list of the places where Barcelona might drop points, away in Seville is certainly one of them. So that's this weekend, while Madrid play Deportivo La Coruña and should win that. Next weekend is the Clásico. So you look at it and think it wouldn't be that amazing if from 8 points we're suddenly down to two. Now, of course, I know that's giving Real Madrid 6 points and giving Barcelona none, as a, you know, even before we start, which is foolish. But there is the potential for that. So, yeah, of course Real Madrid will challenge. I think they will get closer to Barcelona over the course of the season. But 8 points is a hell of an advantage to concede as early as this.
Sid, you mentioned some of the small stories trickling out. Clearly, we know about the whole thing that blew up last season, you know, with Casillas and Ramos. But I mean, what are some of the latest stories?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's been overlooked in the fact that Mourinho reacted to the Sevilla defeat by dropping Sergio Ramos for the Manchester City game is that he also left out Mesut Ozil. And Ozil was forced last night to come out on his Facebook page and say, in four languages, by the way, which was pretty impressive, come out and say, it's not true that I go out all the time. I dedicate my life to playing football. I'm very professional. Now, obviously, one way of looking at it is to say, well, Mesut Ozil is right to say that, and therefore all the stories are nonsense. But the fact that he's been forced into a position to do that, I think, is striking. The fact that Mourinho believes that perhaps he hasn't been as committed as he should have been, I think, is striking. Certainly, there's very little doubt that this is a squad that's relatively divided. Now, divided doesn't mean that they all hate each other and they're fighting with each other all the time, but that perhaps doesn't have that same degree of unity that maybe it had a year ago, and certainly doesn't have the same degree of unity as other clubs and other Real Madrid teams have had in the past. And, you know, all of this comes in the, if you like, in the aftermath of Cristiano Ronaldo saying he was sad but not saying why, which then only makes things worse, because, of course, it provokes a series of discussions. And we are in a position now when we look at Real Madrid where, unfortunately for them, because this is the nature of playing for Real Madrid and the media attention and all the rest of it, every little thing that happens gets analysed and overanalysed, and by doing so, makes things worse.
And last night, Atletico Madrid fought back to beat Real Betis. Can they sustain their challenge? What are they, 2 points behind Barcelona at the moment?
Yeah, just two behind Barcelona, 6 points ahead of Real Madrid, which of course is the main statistic that their fans are excited about. There's also the fact that Radamel Falcao is now a top scorer in Spain. He scored, I think I'm right in saying this, 21 in his last 21 home games. He's just got a fantastic record. He's now scored in every one of the last seven games that he's played across club and country. And they look really solid, they look really strong, although they had to come back from behind last night. And although the refereeing was absolutely appalling, very very much went in Atletico Madrid's favour. The truth is they were the better side and they had far more of the game than Betis did. Afterwards, the Betis president, I think he described it as armed robbery. Well, I'm not quite sure what the referee was armed with. A whistle, I suppose.
Sid, with all the sort of political unrest in Spain at the moment, Pep Guardiola has got involved, I believe, despite being over in the USA.
Yeah, he has to some extent, but it's also consistent and coherent with everything that Guardiola's done and said before. Essentially, the Catalan National Day, the Diada of Catalunya, last week developed into a march in support of Catalan independence. It's a movement that's growing now, and it's getting bigger. The crisis is feeding into it. And Guardiola from New York sent a video basically saying, you've got another vote here. In other words, you know, here's another guy that would vote in favour of Catalan independence. And that, as you can imagine, has caused quite a backlash in Spain within football. And lots of people saying, well, this is a disgrace. He played for Spain and now he expresses this attitude. But of course, there are a million caveats to that. Well, yeah, of course he played for Spain because Spain was the national team he could possibly play for at the time. Guardiola has never hidden the fact sees himself as a Catalan first and foremost, and that he believes in Catalonia as a country, as a nation, not just as a region of Spain. And so him giving his support is perhaps not that serious, but it did create a backlash. A couple of other former Spain players, Alfonso, for example, who played for Madrid and Barcelona, criticised him for it. And as usual, the man, you know, bringing the peace back to everything is Vicente del Bosque, who came out and said, well, Guardiola always gave everything when he played for Spain. He's entitled to have any opinion he wants. It's perfectly up to him. And when he played for Spain, he was, you know, not only was he committed, but this is a guy who could in future be a manager.
And just finally, Sid, you know, carrying on the problems in Spain, protests in Madrid, 64 people injured on Tuesday. Is this a bit like, you know, in the London riots one, if you were away, you look at it and you think the whole of the city's burning and it wasn't. How serious is it?
Oh, it's serious. It is serious. And it's different to the London riots in terms of the causes and I think also the consequences of it in terms of why it's happened. It is serious, but it is also localised. And bear in mind, this is spared precisely because of an attempt to encircle the Spanish Parliament and chant for the government to resign and complain about the nature of the Spanish crisis and the cutbacks, because we're entering into Greece territory now. Even though the Spanish government are trying very hard not to call it a bailout is essentially what it is. And then that provoked confrontations with the police. It's very difficult always to know exactly where the spark is, but the spark appeared to be that some of the protesters tried to basically break down metal fences that were cordoning off the parliament and get through. But the really striking thing about this is the imagery and the aggression of the police, which, by the way, Manchester City fans will be familiar with before the Real Madrid game last week. But on this occasion, the police were very heavy-handed. And the other thing that's really, really, I think, significant in this is there's footage of protesters being dragged away by the police, about to get hit by the police, and shouting out, you idiot, I'm one of you. In other words, there were police infiltrated amongst the protesters, and the clear suggestion from some of the imagery is not just as people to understand what the protesters were up to, but people to be there as agents provocateurs.
Sid, this is a sort of an aside and a relevance, really, given the sort of the wider problems in Spain. But how is it affecting the football? I know, because clearly if you have such a high unemployment rate, it makes it harder for those people to go to games. Is it impacting much on that?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, you look at not the protests themselves. It's very difficult to see the exact point at which, for example, dropping attendances in Spanish games is down to purely to economic issues and to what extent it's down to footballing issues. You know, people thinking, well, I'm not going to watch this team because they're not very good. I'm not going to watch this team because we know they can't win the league. Or I'm not going to watch this team because I can't afford the tickets. Now, I think there's no doubt at all that there is an economic impact on that. And one of the striking things about Spain, which used to be a country that was relatively cheap to go and watch football in, it no longer is. And particularly when you compare it to average wages in Spain, it's now really quite expensive to go and watch football in Spain. Not just at the big two, but some of the other clubs as well. I mean, you see the prices, for example, at Getafe. It just seems absolutely absurd as a business model, as much as anything else, well beyond ethical questions and so on. So that has an impact on the football. The other thing that has an impact, to go back to what we were talking about before about the Catalan issue, is that this has a knock-on effect in terms of the environment around the games. And I think, now obviously time will tell and it's difficult to judge beforehand, but I think we'll see that the Clásico between Real Madrid and Barcelona in 2 weeks' time at the Camp Nou, I think we'll see a Clásico that is infused with a political meaning perhaps even greater than previous ones. I mean, we know that Real Madrid Barcelona is an eminently political rivalry, and I think that Clásico will really, really reflect that. I think it will be really quite interesting to watch, and it may be a really, you know, a pretty serious event. The other thing in all this is that when all this talk about Catalan independence was sparked up by the Catalan Day the other day, Sandra Rosé, the Barcelona president, said, well, if there was Catalan independence, we would continue in the Spanish League. I would imagine we would continue in the Spanish League. As you can imagine, he got slaughtered for that by some people saying, well, you're Catalan, if you want Catalan independence, bugger off and have your own Catalan League. And of course, the bottom line is Rosé is absolutely right. It's in absolutely no one's interest economically for Barcelona to leave the Spanish League.
Right, let's go straight from Spain to Italy. Let's talk to Paolo Bandini. Hi, Paolo.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. So Napoli draw level at the top with Juve. They beat Lazio 3-0, but that game, most notable for Miroslav Klose being an honest footballer.
Yeah, but it was an absolutely remarkable incident, to be honest with you. It was sort of 3 minutes into this game, and it's obviously a match between two teams that are Champions League aspirants. Both had bright starts to the season, but Lazio, certainly any sort of result against Napoli at the San Paolo would be a huge one. And Klose scores this header, or at least it looks like a header, from a corner in the first instance. And he goes off and starts to celebrate, and the Napoli defenders are going absolutely apoplectic, and in particular the goalkeeper, Morgan De Sanctis, is furious. And for about 15 seconds, it appears to be a goal. The goal is, certainly the referee signals for a goal, and Lazio have celebrated a goal. And then it seems that Klose sort of has this change of heart and this moment of conscience where he goes over and tells the referee that, in fact, he'd handled it and it shouldn't stand, at which point the referee, who could book him, does the sensible thing and wipes the goal off and sticks his hand out and shakes Klose's hand, which is quite a nice moment. So it was certainly a remarkable incident when you think about how dishonest so many footballers are these days. And I wonder if Lazio may regret it ever so slightly, given they went on to lose 3-0.
I was going to say, did all his teammates come out and say it was the right thing to do, or did anyone say he should have just taken the goal?
I haven't seen anyone come out and say that he shouldn't have done it. The only thing which I did see, which I thought was a little bit off, was the Napoli manager, Walter Mazzarri, because most of the Napoli players, it was sort of actually a strange image as well, because all the Napoli players then went over and gave him a hug, so it looked like he was suddenly celebrating, having celebrated with the Lazio players, then he was celebrating with the Napoli ones. But after the game, all the Napoli players said, you know, this is the right thing to do, and the Lazio ones who were asked mostly, all the ones I've seen anyway, you know, agreed that it was the right thing to do morally. But the Napoli manager, Walter Mazzarri, came out and said, well, you know, it was the right thing for him to do, but really we shouldn't be congratulating him. We should be congratulating the people who introduced this rule in Italy, where they can now punish players retrospectively. They can show video evidence and give them bans retrospectively. Because basically, Mazzarri was inferring that that's the only reason that he was honest about it. But actually, in Klose's case, you can say that's probably not true, because back in 2005, when he was still at Werder Bremen, there was an incident where he was awarded a penalty in a game against Arminia Bielefeld, and he actually did the same thing then. He went to the referee and said, no, the keeper got the ball first. So he's got previous of being an honest bloke. It looked like he almost wasn't for the first 15 seconds last night, but it's certainly nice that he was.
Paolo, speaking of Juventus, they're playing a Roma this weekend. I watched Roma last night against Samp, and they were quite poor. But clearly this should be a really spicy game with Zemin travelling to Turin. Have the pre-match hostilities started already?
Well, because it's been a midweek round, you haven't had quite as much build-up to it, but certainly it is going to be. And actually, Zemin, obviously, for listeners who aren't so familiar with the backstory, Zdeněk Zeman, when he was manager of Roma last time around, got in a... He basically accused Juventus of doping in an interview with Espresso back in 1998. He commented on the muscular explosion of some of their players, and this led to all manner of court cases and tribunals that eventually saw the Juventus team doctor banned, and then they cleared, and then the whole thing in the end was dropped as a result of the statute of limitations expiring. But so there's a long sort of history of acrimony between Zeman and Juventus. And what you actually had after the Sampdoria game, because Sampdoria are now managed by Ciro Ferrara, who's an old Juventus man, is you had them not shaking hands, and then both of them coming out afterwards and blaming the other one. So Zeman said, well, I'm his elder, so he should have come to me. And Ferrara saying, well, we were the away team, so he should have come to me. So it has already kicked off in that sense, and I think it's certainly going to be the case that we'll have a lot more of these sorts of back and forth in the next couple of days. I'm certain as well that the fans at the new Juventus Stadium will be giving him plenty to think about during the match.
All right, Paolo, thanks very much for coming on.
Sure, no problem.
Appreciate that. Paolo Bandini talking in Italy. I just finished with a tweet. I got a couple. Emma Pugh tweeted us, Rafa, to say, is at Honigstein single? Or is that not the sort of question you meant? Question mark, exclamation mark, question mark, winking emoticon, kiss.
No, I'm very happily married with 3 kids, no less.
Emma, I'm sorry. Oh, and one more final tweet that just says, my oven exploded and the glass inside it shattered, but the outside stayed intact. Explain. This is C. Taylor, 1892, hashtag oven guru.
I can't explain it, but I'd advise him to get a new oven and not try to use it again.
Okay. Thanks very much for your company. All right, we'll speak to you Monday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.